Look over the Bible to 1 Chronicles chapter 2. First Chronicles chapter 2. Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. Continuing our study this morning with the Kenites. There's some valuable information that we can learn from them and from individuals. They are a clan, a nomadic clan, or were a nomadic clan. During the first, probably 500 years of their life, their existence, we find them in the land of Canaan at the time of Abraham. 400 years later, they are still there, much smaller, but having a great spiritual and moral influence with the people of the land, so that the leader of the Kenite clan became known as the priest of Midian, although he was a Kenite as far as his racial or national or social designation. We really didn't have nations back then as we do now. We have more of a concept of tribes and clans being separate entities, kind of like you have in the Arab states today, and as you have in Africa today, where you have each individual tribe being a separate national entity or social block. And boy, did they war among themselves. At any rate, that's a different issue. At the time of Moses, at the time of the Exodus, Moses delivering the nation of Israel from Exodus, the Kenites divided into two groups. One group remained in the land of Midian under the leader of the Kenite clan named Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. And the other division, the other half, the son of Jethro, a man named Hobab, identified with the nation of Israel and lived with them. The Kenite clan under Jethro died out. Jethro died, of course, sometimes. And then the Kenites were either migrated elsewhere or absorbed into the Midianite people. But we have no more mention of them in that geographical area. We now have a mention only of the Kenites in connection with Hobab. They were associated with Israel, and they were a separate clan or entity within the nation of Israel, but totally operating in conjunction with the religious or spiritual information given to Israel. They were very positive to truth, exemplified the principles of truth in their life. Now, we have then some examples of these men. We mentioned last time, we first of all are introduced to a man named Jethro. Jethro was the first man we want to recognize with regard to the Kenites. He was what we call a spiritual giant. And his moral and spiritual integrity took him to the top of his geographical location in which he lived, so that he became known as the priest of Midian. He was the representative of Jehovah. He had a lot of divine viewpoint information which he passed on to Moses for a period of about 40 years. So his official title is Priest of Midian. His most famous functional contribution is the Teacher of Moses. The Teacher of Moses. And Moses had him as his teacher for 40 years. This prepared Moses to face Jehovah on Mount Sinai, and it prepared Moses to go into Egypt. Although Moses didn't think he was ready, the teachings of Jethro prepared him for that. We then have the man Hobab, H-O-B-A-B. Hobab is the son of Jethro, also a spiritual giant. By spiritual giant, we simply mean someone who recognizes the issues of truth and puts them into practice. Jethro did so, and he rose to a very high place of leadership in his land. Hobab, his spiritual moxie, led him to contribute. He contributed, let's just call him the guide of Israel in the wilderness. God of Israel in the wilderness. This was for 40 years. more precisely 38 years, but we rounded off. The guiding actually took place for about 38 years. Hobab was given the choice. Hobab had the choice to go home with his dad, back to the area of Midian, where they lived. But Moses said, we want you to guide us. You know this area better than anybody. We want you to be our guide. We want you to associate with us. Now, Hobab could not become a spiritual leader in Israel because this was relegated to the Levitical priests, to the tribe of Levi. So he became the next best thing, a physical guide to the nation, guiding them through all the pitfalls of this wilderness. Now, he was only a superficial guide from the divine standpoint, because you have the pillar of fire by night and the pillar of cloud by day to be the divine guide of the nation of Israel. But Hobab functioned as a guide of Israel, and his spiritual knowledge is indicated by the choice that he made. He was encouraged to go back with his dad, but Moses said, we need you. He thought it over a few times. He said, okay, I will identify with you. His faithfulness is indicated because after the 40 years of guidance, when the land of Canaan was divided among the 12 tribes of Israel, the people of Hobab, called the Kenites, were given a special inheritance in the land so that they lived with Israel from that time onward. The next great person we encounter is about, several years later, a lady named Jael. Jael is one of those women who finds herself in a very, very difficult predicament. As far as our location goes, if we put Hobab living in the land of Palestine here, and let's see, where was that? South of Eli. So right in this area, in the wilderness of Judah, is where, and of course Jethro is down here further. Midian is down here further. I think my map wasn't as precise yesterday, but Midian is down here. Wilderness of Judah, south of Arad, is where Hobab and his people settled. All right. Now, living with them is Jael and her husband. Her husband is negative to truth, doesn't want anything to do with God, Jehovah, doesn't want anything to do with the nation of Israel, and so he leaves, and he goes way up here in a place called Kedesh. And he takes his family with him. Now, his wife, Jael, is positive to truth. She is interested in promoting not only the cause of Israel, but also for promoting her own spiritual growth. However, she is under the authority of her husband and goes with him. She is right in going with him. She would be wrong in defaulting and staying behind. The reason is because just because she goes up, because he's moving to Kadesh, in the tribe of Naphtali, that's N-A-T-H-T-A-L-I, Naphtali, he's still in Israel, and therefore she still has access to spiritual information. The reason is because you have Levi, the spiritual teachers of Israel, scattered all throughout the 12 tribes. So she has no business saying, no, I'm not going to go with you. She goes then with him. But he's negative, she's positive. She has to pretty much submit to his authority, but this does not limit her from advancing her own spiritual growth and expressing that spiritual growth when the opportunity arises. That opportunity arose when Israel was in conflict with the kings of Canaan, and one of them came to her house. Now, it just so happened that her husband made an alliance with these king of Canaan, and so that they were allies. And this king, who was running from Israel, figured he could find safety in the household of Jael's husband. So he came there looking for help. Well, she, being pretty much helpless as a woman in a military confrontation, couldn't take him on head to head with a sword or anything like that. So she had to just say, well, come on in. This is, you know, my husband's house, and I guess you're welcome here. So she gave him the blanket and said, go cover up somewhere. Go hide. And then when he fell asleep, oh, by the way, he asked for something to eat, so she gave him something to eat, something to drink. Then when he fell asleep, the king took a tent peg and drove it through his head. So he died. That usually does the trick. And then she went outside, sat on the porch, and started knitting, waiting for the two judges to show up. Barak and Deborah were hunting for this guy. And they showed up, and she said, "Hey, the guy you're looking for is in there. Please get him out of here. He's starting to smell." At any rate, she did a military deed in association with the nation of Israel to express her knowledge of truth and her acceptance of truth. This indicates her spiritual maturity. By the way, if you remember from yesterday, she is spoken of very highly in the spiritual song, the Song of Deborah, where Deborah commends her with about six lines there, making a divine recognition of her spiritual, of her military deed, of her deed of valor, as well as spiritual maturity. All right, that brings us to the point 9 in our outline. Now we'll see if everything holds up the way it's supposed to. These things over there are unplugged now. We blew fuses a couple times yesterday. The next man in the Kenite tribe is a man named Rechab. So the point goes, as time goes on, Rechab, R-E-C-H-A-B, Rechab took rulership over the clan. Now see, the clan is living within Israel, and therefore they are basically under Israel's rulership. But each clan, the Kenites were a separate clan, distinct from Jewish designations, and they had their own authority. This authority then, Rechab, as the leader of the Kenites, would be responsible to the leaders of Israel. Alright, as time goes on, Rechab took rulership over the Kenites and promoted truth to such an extent so that the Kenites became tribes. As a whole, the group of this clan became known as scribes. A scribe is someone who is dedicated to the promotion of the written word. It was their responsibility to make manuscripts, to copy from one to another. And the Kenites became very famous for their scribal activities. This is found in 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 55. And of course, that's where we are. We have a simple mention of them, and the families of scribes who lived at Jabez were the Turethites, Shimeathites, Sukathites. Those are the Kenites who came from Haman, the father of the house of Rechab. So you have the Kenite clan broken down into three families. And we really can't trace these three families. You have the three names mentioned there, Cherethites, Shimeathites, and Sukathites. These are three families of Kenites who were devoted to the scribal practice. Okay. This pursuit of truth was perpetuated. Or their outline goes, I'm diverting from yesterday. So at some point, and my outline, this would be subpoint C. Since I didn't give you the subpoints today, I just kind of summarized the information. So if you want to keep that precise outline, then put A. If you're just interested in getting the information, then it doesn't really matter how you put it down there. But my outline is C. I didn't give you B yet. B. This pursuit of truth, was perpetuated by a man named Jonadab. This man is Rechab's son. This is the next highlight of the Kenite clan. Jonadab gained a greater reputation than even Rechab did. Rechab moved the Kenites into the direction of tribal activity, which is the highest calling anyone could have other than that being an actual prophet. The scribes were the ones who lived, ate, breathed the Word of God. They had manuscripts all around them. And you could bet they knew the information that they had made a lifetime, they made it their life's work to copy. Alright, well, Jonadab, one of these individuals, is mentioned in Jeremiah chapter 35, verse 6, as being one who is a leader. We don't need to look at that. Let's not look at that. We looked at it last time. We're going to make mention of him a little bit in our next point. In fact, let's go to letter C, and then we'll have some other things to mention in Jeremiah later. So we'll go back to Jeremiah 35 after we cover these other points. Now I'm ready for letter C. In 982 B.C., which is 982 B.C., so that brings us quite a way. We first saw Jethro in 1441 B.C., and that's when Israel made contact with the Kenites. And now we have approximately 550 years of history. And the Kenites are still going strong. Now, Jonadab is their leader in 982. And this is the year, 982. Jehu, ascended the throne, of Judah. Judah is the southern kingdom of Israel. Jehu is one of the ones who is normally considered a righteous king. And Jehu took upon himself, it was Jehu ascended the throne of Judah, and began to rid the land of idolatry. Now this was quite a chore that he took on for himself. What it involved was, one, tearing down thousands of altars. And temples. Two, killing thousands of cult prostitutes. Now what is that? Well, the idolatry that was rampant in Israel at this time was called the worship of Baal. It's like here, B-A-A-L, Baal. And basically what that is, to make a long story short, is a sexual cult, a sexual religion. In other words, they worship gods, or their gods, plural, they have many different gods. They worship their gods by immoral sex. And part of that was that to be a priest in this cult, you had to be a prostitute. A prostitute is one who gave up his body to others to be used in sexual ways. All right? Well, in order, and the land was just saturated with this stuff. In order to cleanse the land, you first of all have to take care of these idols, or rather the altars in the temple, which included the physical idols. Idols are present there. And then you had to kill the cult prostitutes. So this is quite a chore. It took several kings in order to do it. Jehoshaphat, I believe, is the one who preceded Jehu. He tried to do it, and it only goes so far. At any rate, this is what it involved. he sends the throne, Jehu who began it, but the person who helped him do it was Jonadab. And the outline is kind of messed up now, so let's just make it letter D. Jonadab was a key factor in this activity. It's recorded for us in 2 Kings 10, 15 through 28. Now, this is something that is very beautiful to see someone who is really not associated with Israel racially, but who has been associated with them spiritually for 500 years. It is this man, normally considered a stranger by the terms used in the Mosaic economy. He didn't want to sit up for me. Thank you. But an outsider, and not really a native of the land, a true Israelite, yet it takes someone like this to get the spiritual perspective of the Jews back on course. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 10, 2 Kings chapter 10, and read what happens here. Starting at verse 15. Let's start at let's start at 15. Now when he had departed from there, this is Jehu departing, okay. He met Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, that's our man, coming to meet him, and he greeted him and said to him, "Is your heart right as my heart is with your heart?" In other words, I have a particular viewpoint and purpose in my life. Are you associated with me in that viewpoint and purpose? Now, this is the king speaking, saying, "Jehonadab, are you with me?" In other words, that's what we say, "Hey, are you on my side?" But more than just saying, "Are you on my side?" Are you totally in agreement with me? Is your heart right as my heart is with your heart? Which also indicates that Jehu had a particular liking and compatibility with Jonadab. Jonadab answered, "It is." Jehu said, "If it is, give me your hand." And he gave him his hand and he took him up into the chariot. So he's on a chariot. And I suppose he stopped. He may be going in motion, you know, and you can and talking as they go. Jehu's probably in a hurry. He says, "Well, here, hop up." At any rate, whether it's stopped or moving, you have them joining, you have Jonadab joining him in the chariot. Verse 16, and he said, "Come with me and see my dedication for Jehovah. Come with me, see what I've done to promote the worship of Jehovah." So he made him ride in his chariot. And when he came to Samaria, he killed all who remained to Ahab in Samaria. Ahab was king of the northern kingdom who was promoting this Baal worship, until he had destroyed him according to the word of the Lord which he spoke to Elijah. Then Jehu gathered all the people and said to them, "Ahab served Baal a little, Jehu will serve him much." In other words, all the people who are worshiping Baal are gathered listening to this guy who just killed off their political rulers. You know, now, Ahab, he only worships Baal just a little bit. I'm going to show you how it's really supposed to be done. Okay? Verse 19, "And now, summon all the prophets of Baal." Get all these leaders out here. "All his worshipers, all his priests," which are the prostitutes. "Let no one be missing, for I have a great sacrifice for Baal. Whoever is missing shall not live." But Jehu did it in cunning, in order that he might destroy the worshippers of Baal. And Jehu said, "Set apart a solemn assembly for Baal," and they proclaimed it. In other words, let's have a party for Baal. Then Jehu sent throughout Israel, and all the worshippers of Baal came, so that there was not a man left who did not come. And when they went into the house of Baal was filled from one end to the other. And he said to the one who was in charge of the wardrobe, bring out garments for all the worshippers of Baal. So he brought out garments for them. And Jehu went into the house of Baal with Jonadab, the son of Rechab. And he said to the worshippers of Baal, search and see that there may be here with you none of the servants of Jehovah, but only the worshippers of Baal. So they went around asking anybody, we don't want none of you Jehovah worshippers in here. Are you Jehovah worship? No, no, I worship Baal. Okay. Then they went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings. Now Jehu had stationed for himself 80 men outside, and he had said, the one who permits any of the men whom I bring into your hands to escape shall give up his life in exchange. Now this is a pretty rigid military outfit he's got here. So if you let somebody escape, you might as well just count up your axe and give it up. Then it came about, as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, that Jehu said to the guard and to the royal officers. In other words, he goes through the whole ritual. He wants to make sure everyone there is dedicated to Baal. Anyone there who is a true worshiper of Jehovah won't tolerate this sacrifice to Baal. So he goes through the whole sacrifice. Which, by the way, there's another lesson there. It's not always what you do overtly, it's what's in the heart, what's in the soul. Because he's offering this sacrifice to Baal, but in his heart, he's really not offering the sacrifice to Baal. He's seeking to promote the cause of Jehovah. Where are we then? Verse 25. Then it came about, as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, that Jehu said to the guard and to the royal officers, go in, kill them, let none come out. And they killed them with the edge of the sword, and the guard and the royal officers drew them out and went to the inner room of the house of Baal. And they brought out the sacred pillars of the house of Baal and burned them. They also broke down the sacred pillar of Baal and broke down the house of Baal and made it a latrine to this day. Now you know what that means? That means they took this idol and made it a toilet. That's how to treat idolatry. Thus, Jehu eradicated Baal out of Israel. Okay. But he didn't do a complete job. He did a few problems, caused a few problems. At any rate, who is directly related to, who is directly involved with this? Who's right by this man's side through it all? Jonadab. And we don't have participate here. Now, I made one error, and I have to correct that. Jehu was made king over the northern kingdom, not the southern kingdom. Okay, I mentioned that he was king over Judah in 982. He ascended the throne of Israel. Israel. Okay. Not Judah. So Israel's the northern kingdom, Judah is the southern kingdom. Small issue there. But it's important because if my friend of reference truth is correctly, Jehu is the only good king for the nation of Israel. The only good king in the northern kingdom, there is none other. And he even spoiled it completely. Alright, well, that's just to indicate to you the participation of the Kenites in the history of Israel as we've been tracing it through. Now, let's make some more progress. Letter E. At the time of Nebuchadnezzar's invasion of Judah,
at the
time of Nebuchadnezzar, and I'll tell you what, just put Neb as his name and make it productive. At the time of Neb's invasion of the southern kingdom in 606 BC. So this is 370 years later. Nebuchadnezzar comes in and invades Judah. Judah has adopted the sexual religion to such an extent that the land is now going to be judged by God. And so he uses a foreign power, a foreign king's ruler. The
man's
name is Nebuchadnezzar. To call him Neb for short. At any rate, he invades the land. And at the time of Neb's invasion of the southern kingdom in 606 BC, the Rechabites, which is now their designation, by the way, their official designation is now the Rechabites, because they took on the title of their relative, Rechab. They moved into Jerusalem. The Rechabites were living outside Jerusalem. They were performing their tribal activities in many, many areas. But when the land began to be invaded by Nebuchadnezzar, they moved into Jerusalem. And they were 586 B.C. 586 is when Jerusalem was destroyed. So nobody was left. Well, that's as long as they were there for 20 years. And what happens after that, we'll find out in a minute. The reason they moved into Jerusalem, of course, is they wanted to be closer to the temple. They also needed physical protection, and this was one of God's ways of protecting them, because during that 20 years, the whole land of Judah was constantly under siege. It was Jerusalem that was pretty much under protection. Although it was attacked and put into subjugation, it was not destroyed, whereas many of the other cities were destroyed. So they were there until 586. This is recorded for us in Jeremiah 35:11. And we will look at this now, and our next point will also deal with the book of Jeremiah. In Jeremiah chapter 35, and I think we'll start at verse 8. And we, this is the leader of the Rechabites speaking, and we have obeyed the voice of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, in all that he commanded us, not to drink wine in our days. We, our wives, our sons, or our daughters. Now, this is a dedication principle which I pointed out to you yesterday. They're simply indicating their dedication to spiritual things. Not to build ourselves houses to dwell in. In other words, we're not going to build nice, fancy houses to live in, because we're going to be dedicated to the pursuit of spiritual things. And we don't have a vineyard or a field or a seed. We're not involved with normal free enterprise activity. We have only dwelt in tents and have obeyed and have done according to all that Jonadab our father commanded us. And what Jonadab told them to do was basically worship Jehovah, serve Israel, and so forth. Verse 11, but it came about when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against the land, that we said, come and let us go to Jerusalem before the army of the Chaldeans and before the army of the Arameans. So we have dwelt in Jerusalem. So this is where the Rechabites are now living. The time that this is taking place is a little bit before 586 B.C., the final destruction of Jerusalem. Probably about 2 years before, probably 588, because the message that begins in chapter 34 is very probably 587 or 588 B.C. Okay, now these are the Rechabites speaking, and we simply have a record that they moved when Nebuchadnezzar came into the land, and his first entrance into the land was 20 years before, 606. All right, point E. Last point under 9. As a result of their faithfulness, What's that?
Point.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's E on mine, but I added one. As a result of their faithfulness, they were promised. A share in the temple service. Now, before this, they weren't servants of the temple. They were scribes and other things. They lived pretty much continued living a nomadic life, but in that nomadic life they were dedicated to the scribal activities. They were promised a share in the temple service for the rest of their days. And we'll just say forever. That's the biblical terminology. And this is still Jeremiah 35, 18 and 19. And as I told you yesterday, the reason for God telling Jeremiah to approach the Rechabites and say, all right, you guys, drink wine, was to demonstrate to Jeremiah their faithfulness to spiritual value. Once that faithfulness is demonstrated, God is then going to honor that faithfulness in verses 18 and 19. Then Jeremiah said to the house of the Rechabites, thus says Jehovah of hosts, the God of Israel, because you have obeyed the command of Jonadab, your father, kept all his commands, and done according to all that he commanded you. Now, how would it be that God would be pleased with someone obeying the commands of their father? Only if the commands of their father coincided with the commands of Jehovah. All right, verse 19. Therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Jonadab, the son of Rechab, shall not lack a man to stand before me all the days, as the margin says, or always. We could say forever. Now, to stand before me means intimate service, intimate fellowship, intimate association with Jehovah. And that was recognized in the Old Testament by a close association with the temple. Not necessary, but part of it. But see, the temple's going to be destroyed. So since the temple's going to be destroyed, their temple service has to become totally spiritual. And that's what it means, a man to stand before me all the days, which indicates that Rechab is always going to have a spiritual representative, always going to be someone in the family of Rechab who is a strong believer. Now, this is the foreknowledge of God saying this, not saying that it's going to happen. I'm going to make it happen. It's God's foreknowledge saying, look at the faithfulness of Rechab is such that the positive volition influence, the dedication to truth influence, is going to cause his family to perpetuate standards of truth for many, 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 many days, forever. Okay. All right, let's go to point 10. The general historical security of the Kenites until 586 BC. What happens in 586? Remember? What happens in 586? Temple is destroyed. The city and temple of Jerusalem is destroyed. The general historical security of the Kenites until 586 BC is recorded in the prophecy of Balaam. In Numbers 24, 21. Now, the general historical security of the Kenites, we might want to add that this is in association. This is in association with Israel. Now, that's what we just got done reviewing or overviewing. Is the historical security of these people called the Kenites and the Rechabites and the various things they did and their security in the close association with Israel. Now, in Numbers 24:21, you have this prophesied. Numbers chapter 24, verse 21. Okay, that's at page 237 in the Old Testament. And he looked at the Kenite. This is Balaam speaking. He's the prophet. And he looked at the Kenite. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. I thought you knew those. Well, I guess not. Oh, chapter, huh? All right, well, we'll see about this Friday night. All right. And he looked at the Kenite and took up his discourse and said, "Your dwelling place is enduring, and your nest is set in the cliff." Now at this time, this is 1401. This is 40 years after the Exodus, which is in 1441. And so, if you remember what we've studied, the Kenites are right now closely associated with Israel. In fact, Hobab is the one guiding them. Okay. "Your dwelling place is enduring, and your nest is set in the cliff." Which nest refers to your niche, your place of relaxation, your where you live. Where you are going to make a living. And this, of course, refers to the Kenite existence in the land of Israel. Verse 22 says, the New American needs to be changed. The New American says, "Nevertheless, Cain shall be consumed. How long shall Asher keep you captive?" Well, it should read this. This is the way it should read. Literally. "Is it that Cain shall be destroyed until Asher keep you captive?" So that we have the whole phrase there. The first line should read, "Is it that?" Instead of the word "nevertheless," it should read, "Is it that Cain shall be consumed?" So the rest of the second half is correct. So all you have to do is change the word "nevertheless." The "nevertheless," and it becomes a question. Is it that Cain shall be consumed or destroyed? Is it that Cain shall be destroyed? And then the phrase, "How long shall," is one word, "until." Until Asher takes you captive. Alright, now let me read it again. "Is it that Cain shall be consumed until Asher takes you, Israel, captive?" And it demands a negative answer. No, Cain will not be consumed until Asher takes you captive. And Asher refers to the Assyrian invasion of the land in 711 BC. Okay, now that's the only two verses that relate to this. Verse 23 refers to something else. So we have just 21 and 22 refers to the Kenite. Cain simply refers to the first Kenite. He's called a Kenite because of his name, Cain. Doesn't refer to Cain, the brother of Abel, not that guy. Okay. Now, this is Balaam's prophecy then. He's saying, your dwelling place is enduring, your nest is in the cliff, and it's going to be that way until Asher takes you captive. When Asher comes into the land in 711, that's when, if you remember, under Sennacherib comes into the land, not only the northern kingdom, but the southern kingdom, and just destroys. Well, the Kenites are going to suffer some of that destruction. But they're not going to be harmed. Not a hair of their head is going to be harmed until that time. And as is the pattern established in the Bible, the ones who are harmed during that time are probably the ones who have lost their focus on spiritual reality. Okay. Our next point is number 11, which is our last point, and I have 5 sub-points under it. We'll see if we can get over it, through it. We're pretty much going to amplify point 10. So, as a separate tribal entity, as a separate tribal entity, the Kenites will not be destroyed until Assyria invades All right, A. This prophecy is given, in 1400, I'm going to back up just a little bit, 1402, okay? Let's back up 1 year. I told you 1401, but, you know, we're dealing with just a few months here. Israel has not exactly entered the land yet. The prophecy is given in 1402, or 1401, if you know. How precise do we want to be? I'm simply indicating that the period of the period between the prophecy and the first fulfillment is what we're going to deal with. The first fulfillment is 745 years later. So in other words, the Kenites are going to have that kind of security for 745 years. First fulfillment is 745 years later in 736. That's not going to work out right. I have an addition error. 1402, 736 makes it about 6, makes this about 7, makes this about 6, 676. 676. Still impressive. I mean, that's 3 times longer than this nation has existed. 3 times longer than the United States has existed. Okay, that's the first fulfillment in 736. First fulfillment in, oh wait a minute. All right, first fulfillment is 676 years later in 736 B.C. I sure make a mess of our notes, don't we? You guys probably caught it though. You know, I wasn't changing the BC date, I was changing the number of years. It's still 736 BC when the first fulfillment takes place. And this is the destruction of the Northern Kingdom, the fall of the Northern Kingdom in 736 by Sennacherib. Now, why is this a fulfillment? Because there are Kenites living up in the Northern Kingdom. Remember? Which ones are living up there? The relatives of Jael and her husband, I don't even know if we got his name in there. I didn't bother to look it up. But those are the ones who moved up into Kadesh in Naphtali. Well, that's Northern Kingdom. So they were wiped out. But they're still Kenites, and so they're part of the prophecy. So that's when it's first fulfilled. B. The Kenites of Judges 4:11. These are the ones we're talking about. Living in the Northland, the Kenites of Judges 4:11, are destroyed or consumed in 2 Kings 15:29. These are the ones who departed, of course, after the second division. 2 Kings 15:29 simply records, if I remember correctly, I don't even think it mentions the Kenites, just mentions the invasion of the land. 2 Kings 15:29 says, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and captured Ijon and Abel-Beth-Ma'akah and Genoa and Kedesh. Kedesh. And Hazor and Gilead and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali. So we have a direct reference to the land. And he carried them captive to Assyria. So you have probably a lot of the Kenites being taken. But these are negative Kenites, probably. Jael seems to be the only positive believer when they left in Judges 4:11. And after she died, I doubt if there were too many more positive ones. Any positive ones probably left and went down south, like so many of the Israelites were commanded and instructed to do at times. All right, letter C. We have some Kenites mentioned in 1 Samuel 15:6. All right, let's look at them. Oh, we're not going to... I'm not going to finish these guys today. 1 Samuel 15:6. You have some Kenites living in the wilderness of Judah. This is where they settled. Remember Hobab's family? This is where they settled, in the wilderness of Judah. Saul said to the Kenites, go, depart. Go down from among the Amalekites, leave them, lest I destroy you with them, for you showed kindness to all the sons of Israel when they came up from Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. Now what that means is that they left the wilderness of Judah and went up north just a little bit further. This occurred in about 1073 BC. So they went up a little bit further. They just simply left the area of the Amalekites, who had pretty much dominated the wilderness of Judah at that time. So these moved up a little bit north, still in Judah, and therefore they're destroyed or attacked, let's put it this way, attacked and some destroyed in 711 BC, 2 Kings 18:13. Samuel, all right, let's turn Kings. I know how you guys feel sometimes. Try to find a reference. Now in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. All the fortified cities of Judah. Well, that includes anywhere the Kenites are. So, although that's a general statement, it does tell us that the Kenites are at this time, this is the second fulfillment of the prophecy of destruction of the Kenites. But this is still later, so they've still had a great life. And the last point, D, let's take a few extra minutes here, and probably won't get it on tape. Well, we might. The Rechabites. The Rechabites of 1 Chronicles 2:55. These are the ones who are the scribes, remember? These are the ones who are associated with Jeremiah. We read about them in Jeremiah 35. Rechabites of 1 Chronicles 2:55. They are uprooted because of Judah's discipline in 586. And we already studied, they moved to Jerusalem. So in 586, when Jerusalem is destroyed, these guys are going to be either destroyed or uprooted. Does the Bible tell us what happened? No. However, point one, apply the special blessing. The special blessing of Jeremiah 35. Never lack a man from standing before me. Therefore, probably associated with the Jeremiah remnant. After 586. Now, you need a frame of reference for this. Basically what happened is after the land was destroyed, Nebuchadnezzar took everything over, he left a governor in charge, Gedaliah, and he left Jeremiah in charge. He did not take them captive back to Babylon. And eventually this remnant left. They went to Egypt. And then we don't know anything about what happened to them after that. But, isn't it safe to assume, here we go again, with some biblical logic, that the Kenites who were in Jerusalem, who were positive to truth, following the principle of Jeremiah 35, were associated with Jeremiah throughout this. So since we have no other reference, the Kenites, the Rechabites, are never mentioned again after Jeremiah 35. But the blessing indicates they continue. Whether we hear of them or not, we don't have to. We have the blessing that states that they will never be a man from standing in the, not standing in the face or the presence of Jehovah. Okay, now any of the Kenites, other than the Rechabites in Jerusalem, will probably perish in the discipline of 586 along with any other Israelite. So, if you want to break down the clan to just the Rechabites are those three families of scribes, and if you really wanted to get specific, then we'd have to say, well, the Rechabites are the three families of scribes mentioned there in 1 Chronicles 2:55. These are the ones who moved to Jerusalem, and these are the ones who were recipients of the special blessing, and probably were associated with Jeremiah after the conquest of the land in 586. Now, it's nothing, no strange thing to never hear of the Rechabites again, because we never hear of Jeremiah again. Gedaliah is killed, the governor, and then Jeremiah is taken down to Egypt with a negative group of people, and we never hear of Jeremiah again, and we never hear of the Rechabites again. But I'm sure the same fate that awaited Jeremiah awaited the Rechabites. Whatever happened to him, happened to them. And they probably wandered off somewhere settled and lived a great life because of their positive volition. Truth. The Rechabites, if there are any Rechabites alive today, there is never going to be a man lacking from standing in the presence of Jehovah. If there's Rechabites anywhere, they are believers. Well, not all of them, but I mean there are believers represented in that group of people. All right. Well, there you have a history of a racial group not included in Israel, but having all the same privileges that are entitled to an Israelite, and basically expressing the same dedication to Jehovah as any Jew could. So see, there's no room for any kind of racial prejudice, racial segregation on that basis. It helps us understand a little bit further the racial segregation of Deuteronomy chapter 7. It's a religious issue. Okay, well, we learned some lessons from these people. These people made decisions that caused them to make sacrifices in life. And these types of sacrifices indicated that they put spiritual value above anything else. So we can learn from them. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on trying to make application for you. You can review these guys and see for yourself what kind of examples you have there. That's not our purpose to go into a lot of detail. Our next group, next week, will be the Midianites. We'll look at them now. Not the Midianites, the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites. I have a whole bunch of information on the Gibeonites. Hopefully you'll find it interesting. I'll try to make some spiritual application while we move through it so that we don't get too bogged down just in history. All right, I'm done.